ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A young scientist flees Nazi Germany and ends up building the atomic bomb for Britain and America. But behind the lab coat, he's a Soviet spy. Klaus Fuchs, the physicist who decided the fate of the world and gave the West's greatest secrets to the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app or look for it on the ABC Rewind podcast feed.
This is Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. Later, the story of Joe and Jimmy Governor, Wiradjuri men and the last outlaws in Australia, whose lives and crimes still fascinate us 125 years down the track. But first, it's heartening to know that the United Nations, not always able to solve problems here on Earth, has a committee of 107 nations addressing the peaceful use of outer space. The list of issues under its scrutiny is not short. They include space traffic management, space debris mitigation and remediation, small satellite activities, and space resource activities. Chair of the Working Group on Legal Aspects of Space Resource Activities is an Australian lawyer, Stephen Freeland, Emeritus Professor at Bond and Western Sydney Universities. Stephen is not long back from a series of UN meetings in Vienna that considered, amongst other things, his initial draft principles to govern how we handle the rocks we find in outer space. Stephen, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Stephen, with the world unable to agree how to handle the resources of the ocean floors, what are the hopes for agreement on space?
That's a wonderful question. And of course, these are complex issues, but the idea of space has always intrigued everybody. The idea, stemming back from the Apollo missions, when about 250 kilograms of moon rock were brought back, the idea that the celestial bodies, the moon and other bodies in space, had these resources that could be useful for humanity has always captivated excitement. Space is full of natural resources. Orbits are natural resources. We use them every day. Without them, the world would be literally back in the Dark Ages. So the idea of utilizing the natural resources of space, be they tangible, material, or orbital, has always intrigued us, and it's something that humanity has strived to do. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, of course, depends on your perspective, but it's a forward progression, and humanity wants to see how far it can go in this and other endeavors in space.
There's always, I suppose, been this notion that there may be treasure out there that we have no idea of, that there are rocks and minerals and perhaps gases that might transform our lives. But how real is the expectation of bringing them back here?
I think that's the absolute question, because in more recent times, and I mean in the last 15 to 20 years, companies have lobbied governments, starting in the United States and then elsewhere, saying there are, as you say, these riches. There are, let's call them rare minerals. Mm. There's apparently helium-3, this isotope that combined with fusion technology could create clean energy. There are other materials. And the argument was from these companies that, exactly as you say, we're going to go there, let us say to the moon. To the extent we mine off Earth, we're not mining on Earth, so that has environmental positive consequences for us on Earth, and we're going to mine and bring it back. The only issue with that, besides all of the incredible technical challenges, is there is no economic case that can in any way justify doing that, the costs of going to, let us say, the moon, which is the closest of these celestial bodies, and then performing whatever activities and then coming back, the costs are so much more when compared to the value that is perceived, that it's impossible. And so the whole argument has changed now to say, no longer are we going to go there, mine or whatever the word is, and bring back, but we're going to go, let us say, to the moon and then perhaps elsewhere, and we're going to extract maybe not so much the helium-3 or the minerals, but now the water and the water ice, and use that to create an ecosystem off Earth to support life, to support settlements, if that's the right word. But also with water, apparently you can process it into fuel. So in a sense, when we talk about the moon, to create this ecosystem where the moon becomes a refueling station for further deep space activities. And so the whole argument has changed about resources, at least in the short to medium to longish term, because we're not going to be bringing these things back in any material way.
We're going to use them out there rather than...
We're going to use them out there. And that changes the argument because... One could argue that if we bring back, let us say, helium-3, and we've managed to...
Stephen, what is helium-3?
I'm not the right person, but it's an isotope of helium that occurs apparently naturally on the moon, not so much on Earth. And because of its peculiar properties...
It's useful.
It's very useful if we can master fusion technology and use it for the creation of energy.
So somewhere behind this notion of using the resources out there are dreams of colonising space, are there not?
Well, that's a word that I would absolutely disagree with, and it's contrary to everything... That is the underpinning of the principles about what space is, notwithstanding what certain individuals might say. It's more... The discussion about resources is many things, but of course it's about geopolitics and it's about perceptions of power and perceptions of being the first and the biggest and the best and the cleverest. It's perceptions of perhaps economic gain. It's perceptions of, you know, working in alliances together. And of course, it's also perceptions about maybe helping humanity, but that's one of many perceptions. But colonization, well, it's a word that raises the hackles in the back, the hairs on the back of my neck.
Well, it's a horrible word, but isn't that what Musk is talking about? You know, that he's going to have some kind of last redoubt for the human race on Mars?
That is what he's talking about, but we are easily seduced by some of these people. Obviously, the technology that the private sector has created for space has... marvellous and wonderful in the sense that it allows us to do many, many more things than we otherwise could. But that's a long way from saying that the private sector is going to dictate the future of humanity. And indeed, in the world that I work in, the names of these people just don't come up. They don't come up at all in the UN discussions. They might be in the background in terms of references to the private sector, but really the big issues of space, and there are many big issues, are still to be decided by the community of countries.
This is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Stephen Freeland about the principles that might govern the exploitation of space. Now, Stephen, what are those principles?
Well, the idea, so I'm, as you very kindly mentioned, a chair of a working group, which is the 107 countries, to determine how we move forward based on already agreed foundational principles of a series of treaties, but we need more specifics. How we move forward in this idea that we might be exploiting these natural resources.
Yes.
And so there are clear principles that are important. Without meaning to sound too dramatic, if you look at the history of humanity on Earth, you know, the vast majority of conflicts and wars that we've had have revolved around the notion of resources, either resources themselves or the areas where resources might be. And so all of a sudden, if we're now talking about resources in an area of space, and space from a legal perspective is a common area that we all have a stake in, if we have to be very, very careful that whatever activities take place promote peaceful activities, promote sustainable activities, promote safe activities, are in accordance with foundational international law. So at a high level, the principles that I've had the privilege of doing the first draft and now to be negotiated by the countries really set out what you would expect to see in terms of promoting cooperation, consultation, working together. But of course, we are operating in a highly sensitive area, a highly competitive area, a highly geopolitical area. And so my role is to bring countries from completely different perspectives together to find a consensus idea, so where they all agree on the basic rules of the road, so that they can then get on with it, even if they compete, operating under the same set of rules. The biggest disaster, David, would be that, you know, down the track we have different groups of countries operating, let us say, in a relatively small geographic area on the moon where these concentrations of water ice might be, and operating in their mind's eye under different rules. If they were doing that, that is the recipe for misunderstandings, miscalculations, and worse. And so even if they're not going to necessarily work together, they need to operate under a common set of rules. And I think they all understand that, notwithstanding the incredibly challenging geopolitical times we're in, we're still able to move forward. We've still got a long way to go, but we're still able to move forward on this idea that if we have a common set of rules, then that will allow us to get on with it and we'll try to be better and bigger and faster than you. But at least there's an element of understanding about how others will react in certain circumstances.
But Stephen, what are the fundamental common rules that you would like to see in place?
So peaceful, that these activities are peaceful, that these activities are safe, that these activities take into account many, many environmental concerns, that these activities are to be shared, the benefits of these activities are to be shared in some equitable way around the world, that these activities take into account ethical and indigenous and cultural perspectives, that these activities promote cooperation, that these activities promote the idea that information is shared amongst. These all sound like very high-level principles, but high-level principles are what we need at the moment, because the reality is we are a long, long way from this actually happening technically, and therefore to set these foundational principles and then subsequently, as we begin to understand what these activities will actually look like, what sort of things will people be looking to do, we can add the specifics. But you need to understand that you have this foundational framework around which every activity must follow.
It sounds to me, look, I know I'm an old grump, but it sounds to me that you're trying to reverse the ordinary expectations of the human race going back to the beginnings of time, which is, if you mount an expedition and you invest in it, you pay for it, and you go out there and you discover something, it's yours. And the notion of then sharing it with people who haven't mounted an expedition, who haven't paid for an expedition, is just utopian. I can't imagine the United States of America having found, say, a mystery new mineral on, you know, a distant planet that is going to transform life on the planet, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, sharing it with China, Russia, Hungary, Spain. How can you expect that? It's very UN, but is it rational?
This is, of course, the question that many people ask. But if you go back right to the beginning of space and then the regulation of space, so, you know, following 1957, the Sputnik 1 launch, and then a series of understandings amongst protagonists in the Cold War, but yet they formed this idea that no country can appropriate space, you can't claim it to be your own, that the notion of space is based on cooperation and consultation. Now, we all understand the reality. Of course, it flies in the face of the way we perceive territory on Earth. But space is different, I would argue. From a legal perspective, it's different. From an ethical perspective, it's different. And here's the real rub to this. We are all dependent on space. I always say that every person on the planet is touched by space. You and I, David, and everybody listening to this has used space today 30 times.
There's something in space that tells me how to get to Burwood.
Absolutely. But there's something in space that allows you to travel, manage your crops, look at the weather forecast, watch television. It keeps the lights on. Every aspect of our society is determined by space. Every country is the same, obviously to slightly different degrees, but every country is dependent on space. We have major challenges already because of some of the other issues you mentioned, debris, the environment, the competitiveness, sadly also perceptions of military uses of space, all of those things are major challenges. But here's the rub. If we get it wrong, everybody suffers. And it's different in a sense from the other great challenge we have in the world, climate change. So with climate change, if we get it wrong, everybody suffers. Australia suffers, you know, everybody here. But who suffers the most in climate change? It'll be the poorer countries, the low-lying islands, etc. If we get it wrong in space, given that every country in the world is dependent on it, who will suffer? We will all suffer, but who will suffer the most? It'll be the major countries because they have the greatest capabilities in space, the greatest infrastructure in space, but therefore the greatest dependency and the greatest vulnerability. And if we get it wrong, if space becomes unsustainable because of, you know, competitiveness becoming something worse, then all of those major countries will not be able to utilize space to their competitive advantage in the way they have in the past. And it, in a sense, will bring them all down and the lights go out everywhere. So there is a powerful undertone to find this balance, this equilibrium between geopolitics and I want to be the biggest and the best and the brightest, myself and my like-minded. But also, if I go too far, if I cross red lines, if I don't necessarily play the game, then in the end, we all will suffer. And I know many people think, well, that's not going to happen. The United States can do whatever it wants. Russia can do whatever it wants. The difference now is that whereas before there were really one major space power, now that space is a multipolar ecosystem. The Americans still have major capabilities, but so do the Chinese, and so do the Russians, and so do the Indians, and so do the Japanese. And so it's not as if one country or even one small group of countries can dominate now. Mm. And so we just have to find that equilibrium.
Stephen, that seems to me to be an unanswerable, rational argument. Okay. You've just come back from a series of meetings in Vienna. How are the countries getting down to work and working together to approach an understanding like that? I mean, is it all sunlight in Vienna?
So they have a draft that sets these high-level principles, and this is a public document that's on the UN website. Of course, various countries will push their particular way of seeing what these rules should look like. And so we have a group of countries under what's known as the Artemis Accords, Australia is involved in that, that have a particular perception about lunar activities.
Yep.
We have another group of countries, primarily led by China with Russia, and there are groups of countries and organisations that are looking to set up what's called the International Lunar Research Station, ILRS. They have their own perceptions. We have a whole range of other countries. We have Australia, which is a party to all of the space treaties, including one that already talks about space resources. They will want to protect their rights. So we have a whole range of different perspectives, let alone all of the cultural and indigenous and industry and civil society ideas that are filtered through the countries into these discussions. So the debates are tough, but it's about words. But what I've found, because my initial draft was based on 3 years of inputs from all of these countries, it's not as if I made it up myself. What I found is, at this high level, they all agree. It's better to have rules about safety.
Sure.
It's better. And so we are, the discussion is about words. It's not necessarily about concepts, at least at that high level. And so we're actually, notwithstanding the way the world is, all of the countries are curious, and I think at this point engaged, to see how far we can go to reach an agreement. We have until 2027 to reach that agreement.
You're drafting law.
We're drafting rules that have to stand the time, not for 1 or 2 or 5 years, but for 30 or 40 or 50 years. Sure, we might add to it as we develop more and more technology, but these are the foundational notions that move forward. So of course it's tough, but you know, one has to be cautiously optimistic. Anything can happen, but otherwise I wouldn't do it.
You know? Cautious optimism drives a number of trades. Stephen, you've said several times, words, words, meanings of words. What languages will these principles end up in? How many languages?
There are six official UN languages.
And they'll all have to, for those six languages.
So we have Chinese, Arabic, Russian, French, Spanish, and English. Every document, including my initial draft, is translated into those six languages. Of course, that in itself causes complexities because languages are never perfect.
Of course.
But by and large, I mean, through the history of multilateral organisations, you know, these documents are translated in these various languages, and we find a way. They're not perfectly in alignment, but they are as much as possible. But they're all of equal status.
Yeah. The lawyer's arguments around translations. But now, look, let me imagine the scene. There are representatives of 107 countries gathered in some abandoned palace in Vienna. And in that room are representatives of Ukraine and Russia, Israel and Iran, nations at war with one another. How do they get on?
Well, this is the point where I've learnt that countries are not necessarily entirely rational in what they say, and that points of order and comments and statements that are made are driven not just by the narrow issues of space, you know, that we're talking in the room, but about everything else. So you mentioned a few. Let me throw in also Greece and Turkey, who have major disputes, to the point where one will say the sky is blue and perhaps the other will say, well, that's not true.
Or worse, Stephen, one will say the sky is blue and the other will say the sky is blue and mean something completely different.
That's true. And of course, words can have different interpretations. So, yes, there is a lot of tension in the room. There are a lot of statements in the room. And you mentioned some countries. There are many other countries that have differences with each other. And yet, and this is hard for some people to perceive, because there is this idea that the UN is cumbersome and it never works. And of course, there are many problems with this process. But at least I've found that we continue to move forward notwithstanding. But of course, the tensions make it harder. I mean, getting consensus in a world of where consensus is impossible on large issues is a real challenge. But as I said, my role is to make it clear to states that it's in their interest to allow this to progress forward, notwithstanding everything else. And of course, that's hard. But this is an issue where I think they understand that in the end, they're better off having some rules, whatever they look like, than allowing, you know, the Iran-US situation or the Israel situation or Ukraine and Russia, allowing that to get in the way. We don't know, though. I mean, countries change their policies all the time. We don't know, for example, if the US will have a different view next year than it does this year. But at the moment, they're all very supportive.
Is there a problem on Earth that would not be solved if we had a few rules? And you want to bring rules to space. Now, I commend you enormously for this effort, and we'll keep a close eye on it on Late Night Live. Stephen, thank you for joining us on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, David.
I've been talking to Stephen Freeland, an Australian space lawyer who chairs the Working Group on Legal Aspects of Space Resource Activities at the United Nations. Up next, the true story of Jimmy and Joe Governor, the Wiradjuri men who inspired, amongst other things, the film The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith. This is Late Night Live. So many acres of newsprint were devoted to them at the time, and so many books have been written about them since, and 50 years ago a landmark film was made about their exploits, that it takes a brave woman to write anything more about the brothers Joe and Jimmy Governor, Wiradjuri men who brutally murdered 9 people in central New South Wales in 1900. That brave woman is my guest today, Catherine Biber, author of The Last Outlaws, The Crimes of Jimmy and Joe Governor and the Birth of Modern Australia. Catherine is Distinguished Professor of Law at UTS. Her field is evidence. Her interest in the Governor brothers goes back about 20 years. Her podcast on their crimes and trials, also called The Last Outlaws, won a slew of prizes a couple of years ago, including the New South Wales Premier's History Award and also Podcast of the Year. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you, David.
Why does this story grab you? Why?
Oh, there are so many reasons, David, and the reasons have changed over time. Originally, it grabbed me through the film, and I was shocked after seeing the film to learn that it was based on true events that I had not heard about or studied. So it started by me feeling that this story should be more well known. I was surprised that it wasn't more well known, and I went looking for it in more kind of conventional books about Australian history, and either it was entirely omitted or it was mentioned in passing with a kind of shame or a sense that it didn't quite fit the narrative. But I've returned to it over and over again, trying to work out how this story can be inserted into a broader understanding of Australian history, because I started with a hypothesis that the response to the Governor brothers actually shaped modern Australia. And when I went looking for evidence of that, I found a lot of evidence. And so this is my attempt to demonstrate how Jimmy and Joe Governor brothers' crimes and the public response to them were actually instrumental in shaping the institutions that we rely on today and which made modern Australia.
Okay. Now, that's a big, big aim.
Yes.
Let's go back to the crimes themselves. What did those young men do?
Well, as you've said, they murdered 9 people. 7 of their victims were either women or children. One of those women was heavily pregnant, already in her confinement. They also very seriously injured other people who did not die of those injuries. 2 of their murder victims were white men. They also committed other crimes, primarily robberies. Jimmy Governor was also accused of raping a teenage girl, although that was never investigated and he was never charged with that offence. But for a period of 3 months, commencing with 9 murders, they committed a range of other crimes on the New South Wales late frontier and were very, very difficult to capture.
And they were the focus of extraordinary interest from the public and the press. This was an archetypal Australian press story, was it not?
That's right. Look, today criminologists would call the press response a moral panic because every theory, every clue, every fragment was reported on and discussed in the media, often with no evidentiary basis.
So you make that clear in the book. There is, in a lot of places, for the most colourful details, no evidence, whatever.
That's right, but they made great copy. And I suppose the media is one of the institutions that my book argues was shaped by this case because it created scandal, it created sensationalism and all of the kind of contemporary tropes that we rely on in reporting on crime and the public response to crime are all evident in the public report, in the media reports on this case.
Can I suggest a theory? And I'm going to use the language of the time, and that's this, that a great deal of the fascination about Jimmy Governor lay in the contrast between his brutal crimes and the notion that he was really the best kind of young black. He spoke good English. He'd had a bit of education. He played cricket. Catherine, he played cricket. And yet he did these crimes. What do you think of that theory?
Yes, that's a powerful theory, and I think it's also important to remember that we're talking about the language of the times. But he did what most of the white governors wanted Aboriginal people to do. He spoke English, he read and wrote English, he had a job, he worked for white people.
Good worker.
He was a good worker. He was skilled in all of the kind of rural trades that needed skilled workers. He was willing to travel for work. He was willing to employ others to help him to do the work. So in many ways, he was exactly the kind of entrepreneurial, hardworking frontier man. But he crossed the line, many people believe, by taking a white woman as his wife.
Now, when you look at the explanations for the crimes, how strongly do you give the role of Jimmy Governor's wife, Ethel, in those killings?
Well, I suppose, and you're right, my field is evidence and I've examined the evidence and there's a huge volume of evidence. It's very difficult with the distance of time to know how important any individual item of evidence was at the time. But it's true that there was evidence that his wife, who was white, experienced humiliation from white people for taking a black man as her husband and also having children with him. And those children were humiliated for being of what we would not today call mixed race. So certainly she was very unhappy and certainly she was telling him about his unhappiness and he absorbed a lot of her anger and unhappiness and it was a factor.
She was at the time, like her husband, working for the Morbury family and there is evidence, is there not, that she was humiliated by the Morbury women. Mrs. Morbury, a governess in the household, had been particularly humiliating to Ethel. One of the things that fascinates me about the killings is that there had been a row between Ethel and Jimmy in the hours before the killings. He went off with his brother Joe, committed the killings. They didn't kill Morbury. They killed Mrs. Morbury. They killed the women in the household. Does that count, and I'm speaking to a professor of the law of evidence here, does that count in sort of a vague notion that Ethel set him on to do those crimes?
Yes, that's a hard question to answer. I suppose today we use the language of provocation. And there was a version of provocation at the time, and certainly many defendants, including people who were defendants in homicide cases, used some kind of provocation defence successfully. None of those were Aboriginal people, but certainly a kind of provocation that was an accumulation of humiliation and accrued unhappiness was used in evidence to excuse people of their crimes.
Now, we'll get to the trial, but before we get to the trial, having committed these murders, Joe, Jimmy and their mate Jack Underwood fled into the bush. And though there was an immense manhunt, they evaded capture for how long?
It was about 3 months.
About 3 months. And that gave them a kind of magical status as well, didn't it, in the eyes of the press and the public. Fearful but magical. They had got away.
Yes, that's right. And that's why the press started to report every theory and clue, because it was thought that they had these kind of skills and abilities to elude capture, to hide their footprints in the bush, to subsist on who knows what. They certainly had very advanced skills in survival in the bush, as did many people who lived in the region, but there was a very kind of satisfying media commentary about a kind of dialogue they were having with their hunters. It was thought that they were leaving clues for their hunters. They would leave, apparently, notes for their hunters. Sometimes they would steal flour and they would use that flour to leave footprints on the ground. So it was thought that there was this kind of seductive dance between them and their pursuers, which was designed really to humiliate the police, because the longer they couldn't be captured, the more humiliation accrued to the police who couldn't find them.
And that was always amusing for the public, for the police to be a bit humiliated, even in the midst of a panic. But was there also a sense that we were back to the bushranger days?
Well, that's right. And that's an interesting term, because many historians have thought that bushrangers were finished by 1900.
Yes,
all over. So the term was kind of thrown about occasionally, but it felt like it was not the right term anymore for what they had done. So there wasn't really agreement about what label to use for these men. And I also am not sure what label to use. I mean, today they might be mass murderers or serial killers. Some people have thought they're freedom fighters, but I don't think there is any kind of convenient label in Australian history to put on the Governor Brothers.
But you bring to this argument a fascination with an almost exhausted form of law, outlawry. Now, the Kelly brothers had been outlawed, and now, after a political uproar, the Governor brothers were outlawed. Now, what did it mean to be outlawed?
Yes, so actually outlawry in Australian history has a long history, but you're right. There was an instrument called the Felons Apprehension Act. It was first introduced in 1865 by Sir Alfred Stephen, and the idea of outlawing someone under the Felons Apprehension Act, and each act was supposed to apply to a named individual, was to proclaim them an outlaw. They would have to go through a process that was approved by a Supreme Court judge, who would affirm that this person was guilty of a crime and could not be captured. So it's a finding of guilt without a trial. And these people would have 14 days to surrender themselves. And if they did not, then after that 14 days had elapsed, they could be captured dead or alive. And if they were captured dead, then those who killed them would not be guilty of a homicide.
How many times were people actually formally in this way declared outlaws in the colony? Because I think you argue, and I would argue, that it was not really necessary to go through these formalities. But how many times were there sort of formal declarations? This person is an outlaw.
So these formal declarations were made 10 times, and Jimmy and Joe Governor were number 9 and 10.
Well, but isn't that how the law operated on the frontier anyway? People were shot, killed, particularly Indigenous people were shot and killed, and nobody bothered much. The law was somehow didn't apply to them. It was as if they were already, without declaration, outlaws.
That's right. And in fact, and this is something that the book does explore a little bit, there is a much longer history to outlaws in the Australian colonies, and there were also formal declarations. Whether the word outlaw was used, it was used haphazardly. Sometimes people were declared ruffians or other, you know.
I like that, ruffians.
Ruffians.
A formal declaration of ruffianism.
That's right. Some were declared daring banditti.
No.
And so this kind of language goes back actually to the very earliest years of the convict era, where originally convicts were declared outlaws. These were convicts who had re-offended whilst in the colonies. But also we start to see outlawry proclamations being made against First Nations people. Sometimes it's made against convicts who've gone to live with Aboriginal people.
And yes, the ones who went over to the other side.
And sometimes they're made against Aboriginal people who have, for some other reason, fallen afoul of the colonial governors.
I'm talking to Professor Catherine Biber about her book, The Last Outlaws, a book that examines the crimes and trials of the Governor brothers. Catherine, Joe Governor was shot and killed. What happened to his body?
Well, Joe Governor was shot and killed outside the New South Wales town of Singleton in a very remote area. And so police took a very, very long time to arrive at the body, and they threw him over the back of a pack horse and conveyed him to the road. And then by road, they conveyed him to Singleton, where they laid him out on the billiard table in the Caledonian Hotel. The Caledonian Hotel is still in Singleton. At this time, though, they held coronial inquests in regional areas, often in pubs. And so they held a coronial inquest in the Caledonian Hotel. Joe's body was laid out on the billiard table, but not in the public bar. But a jury was convened, because juries served on coronial inquests at that time. A jury was convened from amongst 12 men who were just drinking in the pub. And an inquest was held into the cause of his death, because as we know, shooting dead an outlaw is not a crime, but the court needed to be satisfied, the coroner needed to be satisfied that he was an outlaw and that he was Joe Governor and that the people who shot him knew those things. And so a full legal proceeding happens in the pub, and it concludes that his killers were not guilty of a crime. But also it reveals that there were transactions made between colonial legal figures and colonial medical figures. And what I learned was that his body, after his inquest, was trafficked into the global body trade.
Why was there such an interest, particularly in the brains of Indigenous criminals?
Well, it's important, I suppose, to remember at this time, anatomists, the field of anatomy is developing. And within the field of anatomy is a subfield called neuroanatomy. And anatomists and other scientists at the time are trying to understand the spectrum of humanity and how humans differ from non-human animals. So they're really trying to plot creatures on a spectrum, or we would say a hierarchy, probably a racial hierarchy. And so, yes, they were interested in Aboriginal people and where Aboriginal people fit on this hierarchy. But of course, Aboriginal people and their brains were trafficked just as much as the brains and remains of other kinds of peoples. And when I tried to investigate what happened to the remains of Joe Governor, I discovered a whole world in which First Nations people's remains, but also the remains of all of humanity and also all the other creatures that were not human, were being trafficked by very, very eminent scientific gentlemen across the globe.
You write that the examination of Indigenous body parts, particularly brains, was to justify imperialism. What did you mean?
Well, in large part, when we talk about the making of modern Australia, we are talking about the kind of legal instruments that created the nation. But in this part of the book, we remember that scientists played a very important role in the making of modern Australia, and that science and what we would call racial science was very important to our understanding of society, social hygiene, public health. All of these important institutions of modern nation-making were developed by scientists, including scientists who traded in human bodies. And so it's really just a reminder that the making of a nation is not just about a constitutional agreement amongst lawyers, but it's also being developed, in this case, by scientists and anatomists who are trading human and non-human remains because they think that's important to understanding the society that they are going to be governing.
So that's Joe. Now, Jimmy is finally captured and brought to trial. Now, part of the fascination of this book is the examination of the legal procedures. I mean, you know, as I was a lawyer for a couple of days, Catherine, a long time ago, and I loved this examination of the many awful breaches of little rules and big rules in bringing Jimmy to trial. Now, we've only, alas, got a few minutes left. Firstly, I want to ask, Ethel, when she gave evidence, didn't really help her husband, did she?
No, it's true. Ethel gave evidence probably in exchange for her own freedom because she had been charged and was ultimately not brought to trial.
Yeah.
And it's not clear whether she and Jimmy had made an arrangement about the evidence she would or wouldn't give, or whether she was overwhelmed. It's important to remember she was 18 years old and pregnant with another child, and probably desperate and incredibly precarious. She was living in the benevolent asylum at the time and had no idea of what lay ahead of her. But it's true, the evidence she gave did not really help Jimmy Governor.
Now, we won't go through all of the irregularities of the trial, but do you think, even if the trial had been perfectly conducted, even if Jimmy Governor had had solicitors and barristers representing him with actual experience of the criminal law, which these ones didn't, do you think he could possibly have been acquitted?
No. I don't. It's true his lawyers were not experienced criminal lawyers, and it's true that there were much better criminal lawyers available in the colony. He did have an appeal, though, and on appeal, yes, he did have one of the best barristers. And as soon as, after Federation, the High Court was established, his barrister was appointed to the first bench of the High Court, mm-hmm, Richard O'Connor. So even though he didn't have the best lawyers at his trial for the crime he was accused of, he had a pretty good shot. And also, I think his judge was very fair. And so in the legal context at the time, he had the best available opportunity for an acquittal. But I don't think any jury at this time would ever have acquitted an Aboriginal man accused of murdering 9 white people on the colonial frontier.
Nor today, surely.
Probably not.
Mm. Now look, there's so much here. One of the details, the little details that I found extraordinary was, firstly, that most people condemned to be hanged were not hanged. Most had their sentences commuted. Most Aboriginal men and women committed to be hanged also had their sentences commuted. What decided that Jimmy Governor would actually hang?
Yes, that is true. At this time in 1900, mercy, which was a commutation of someone's death penalty, was more commonly dealt than not. And it's true that the colonial hangman at this time mostly did other things. He worked in the garden in Darlinghurst Jail. He washed the dishes in the Darlinghurst Courthouse.
And he was a dud at his job.
That's true. He botched a lot of his executions, probably because there were not that many people he was hanging. But I don't think that Jimmy Governor could ever have been given mercy because of the politics of this time. And this is really the argument of the book. This case is very closely entangled with the emerging nation that is literally days away from the delivery of his death sentence. And so the shadow of nation-making looms over the decision to execute him, which was made by the Executive Council after it was delivered by his judge.
And once he was waiting to be hanged, he was descended on by people who somehow wanted to make their own careers out of the prospect of his death.
That's right. He waited a long time in the condemned cell at Darlinghurst Jail, longer than normal. The normal procedure was that you would have 3 Sundays and then you would be executed, but he waited much longer. It's not, many have said that he was waiting until after the Federation celebrations had concluded. I never found a document that proved why his sentence was supposed to be delivered on the 18th of January.
Because as he waited there, the processions were being held all around Australia, documents were being signed, the nation was coming into being.
The Federation celebrations paraded down Oxford Street outside the jail. The jail provided the electricity for the lights that powered the Federation decorations on Oxford Street. So yes, whether those two events were literally connected, I never discovered. But it's true that whilst he was waiting, a huge parade of visitors entered the condemned cell. And one of them was a young missionary called Retta Dixon, who visited him 23 times in 1 month.
Brought him to the Lord, did she not?
She said that she did. She believed that she brought about his salvation prior to his execution. And later in her life, she wrote a memoir that she never published, but which is in the State Library of New South Wales, about the days that she spent praying with him in the condemned cell. And she would become a hugely influential missionary in the lives of Aboriginal people. Her mission was very, very important and very impactful in the Christianisation of Aboriginal people.
But alas, we have no time to follow the career of Retta. Catherine, thank you for joining me on Late Night Live to discuss the story of the Governor Brothers.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
I've been talking to Professor Catherine Biber, author of The Last Outlaws. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show. On our next, that wise and funny man, Tim Minchin, as he turns 50. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.